Welcome to Bookish Podcast with Kath and Al, a podcast about books-ish. A quick disclaimer before we start, there may be some spoilers, so please save the episode for later if you don't want any. And also, please follow us on social at We Are Bookish Pod. We hope you enjoy.
Hello.
Hello. Hey, girl. Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, and welcome to the book podcast, ladies.
Yeah. Everyone, not just ladies, sorry.
But mostly girls, gays and theys. Is that what people say? This is my girls, gays and theys. No, obviously, hello everyone.
Hello everyone. Sorry, I got very nervous then and just said ladies, like default. I think because also like looking at our analytics, that's like mostly our audience. But hey girls, gays and theys, how are you going?
And everyone in between.
And everyone in between. Welcome to Bookish Podcast. We're really going well here.
I'm Kath.
And I'm Elle. And I feel like we've just like want to actually introduce ourselves, and we might end up doing that a little bit more than you're used to if you're a regular listener, because we've had a lot of new subscribers to the podcast recently, which is very lovely. So hello, welcome, how are you? We hope you're doing well. Thank you for joining us today, because this is a very special podcast episode, isn't it, Kath?
Very special.
This particular episode of Bookish is brought to you by the folks at the Tandem Collective. So thank you for sponsoring this episode. We were very lucky.
Very excited. Sponsored episode, guys.
Like, also, like, thank you for believing in us. Like, obviously, you've seen our content and you felt like we would resonate with with our audience for the stuff that the content you have. So, like, we're very grateful. I feel like my earrings are clicking against the anyway we're here today because we were very lucky to have gone to a preview screening of the film American Fiction, which is out in cinemas now. First and foremost, go out and see it. Like, drop everything that you're doing, go to the cinema and see it.
Go on Mondays, it's cheaper. Which, actually, this is Sunday right now, but you won't hear this episode tomorrow, probably. So next Monday, go on a Monday, it's cheaper. That's my advice.
Or, you know, make good on your, compare the meerkat.com cheap Wednesdays.
Or do that?
I think so.
Oh my God. I need to redo my, like, contents insurance. Maybe I'll do it by that and get some cinema tickets. You know what else as well? I feel like you can get cinema tickets if you've got like health insurance, like anything like that. And actually, if you have Sky Cinema, they're now doing cinema tickets. Like every month you can get like two cinema tickets or something. I can't remember what the thing is. But I think that's really clever. I think that's a really good like hookup, because people who pay for Sky Cinema are probably really into films, right? So it makes sense. And if you've got a family and you get two free tickets and you get another, how you buy the rest of the tickets. I mean, it makes sense. I think it's perfect.
And I think there's something to be said about the cinema going experience anyway.
I agree. Yeah.
Because I would default maybe in like waiting for it to go on Netflix or Amazon Prime. Like this particular film, American Fiction, is an Amazon Prime MGM production. And so it's going to end up on Amazon Prime at some point for people to watch. But actually going to cinema, actually going to the Curzon where we had the film screening preview even, and like getting like a hot dog and popcorn. And
you love a hot dog.
I love a hot dog. Every time I go to the cinema.
When we went to the football, you got a hot dog. When we went to the other football, you got a hot dog. Maybe it's just a
hot dog girly. I love a sausage.
Because I went to Asian supermarket today and they had these hot dogs and their packaging was so nicely designed. I wanted to buy them, even though I didn't want to buy the hot dogs. But anyway.
Product marketing.
Ding, ding. Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, it does, there is an experience that you get going to the cinema that you wouldn't necessarily have doing it from home. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't do it from home. Obviously, if you can watch these things and it's more accessible to you, because for example, like my cinema in Walthamstow no longer exists. That's like the second time that's happened. I'm a Walthamstow girly from day dot. there's no cinema there. I have to either go to Enfield or go to Stratford or go to like in town. And so it's not as accessible. And I have therefore gone to see Oscar worthy movies like American Fiction, which we will get to, at home. And I don't necessarily want to do that. Like, there's something about seeing it in detail in a cinema screen.
Yeah. And actually, like, if I don't go to the cinema for ages and then I go, I'm like, why didn't I do this more often? So I think, because actually for a while, like, Tom and I, he got cinema tickets with his health insurance. So we used to go every now and again, but you could only go to like View or Odeon, and the closest ones to us are like in like central London. So you have to go to like Covent Garden or Leicester Square, and no one wants to be in Leicester Square at 10 p.m. after the cinema. Like, you want to be a 10-minute walk from home. But I do like the Picture House cinemas, and when I, because to be fair, like when I lived in Clapham, it's like a 10-minute walk to the Picture House, and then like Tom lived in Brixton for a bit, and then we had the Ritzy, and they were just like really like they're not fancy cinemas, but they're just nice experiences. And I feel like there's a bit more of that now, isn't there, with like Curzons and like
Everyman,
that's it.
Odeon Lux.
Yeah, I think I need to go to more, definitely.
I felt inspired to go to more since seeing American Fiction. And that's not to say that this hasn't been a film that I've wanted to watch. I actually think a lot of the films that have been nominated for Oscars this year, are all, a lot of them I would actually want to go and see in the cinema. I have a list. And like, that's one ticked off. American Fiction's done. I'll go through the rest and get to them before the Oscars happen, before they come out of cinemas. But
yeah, I also think it is, it's a nice film to watch in the cinema, but also a nice film for like an evening where you're not doing anything and you want to watch a film. Like, I think it does both, and I think that's often like a film that's like fairly easy to digest. I think often like blockbusters that are in the cinema are less like, oh, I'm chilling at home on a Friday night with a glass of wine and I want to watch something that's like not trash, but like not like, I don't know, not like a super hardcore action film or something that's gonna like keep you on your toes. So yeah, no, it's good. But it's interesting that I probably end up on Amazon Prime, because I feel like we've seen a lot of films go straight from cinema to streaming, haven't we? Like in the space of like a month. So I will be intrigued to see how long it takes for this to go to streaming.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, I think Saltburn's an MGM Amazon Prime production. I watched that on Prime. I didn't go to see that in the cinema. I know that you could. May, December, I know we've spoken about that in a previous episode. That was also one that was released, limited release at cinemas, and then in the US you could watch it on Netflix, and in the UK it was released via Sky Cinema, so you had to watch it there. But this is a really accessible movie. It's a satirical movie. It's very funny, but it also uses humor to tackle some key themes and subject matter, and there is an incredible amount of heart to American Fiction. It's so heartwarming, so heartfelt. It's so moving. It's so nuanced in its discussion. It's not black and white. There's lots of grey area. And I think the way that they use the cast, the characters, the settings, is, it really brings that to life. So what is American Fiction about?
Yes. So American Fiction is based on the novel Erasure, that was published in 2001 by Percival Everett, who has since but in his time and career written 30 books, by the way, of like quite different like genres, which is astonishing. And that's what the film is based on, the book Erasure by Percival Everett. And it's, the whole premise is, it's about a novelist who's completely fed up with the establishment of the publishing industry profiting from black entertainment. Sorry, I just tripped over my words there. And he basically, he's like highbrow literature, and he writes all these books and stuff, and then he is not getting published. And basically, long story short, won't tell you the whole story because you need to go watch the film. He uses a pen name to write a novel that propels him into the heart of hypocrisy and the madness that he claims to disdain, basically. That's a nice little... Did you write that, a little roundup?
No, I took that from IMDb.
I was like, this is lovely.
I can't write. Come on now. She is not a writer.
Anyway, so I didn't say that very well, but basically it's a book about the publishing industry, how it profits off like black stories that it wants to hear, and is basically a criticism of that. Interesting that the book was written in 2001 and obviously the film is in 2024 now, but obviously filmed in 2023, and all of the themes still ring true today. So yeah, it was directed by Cord Jefferson and it was his directorial debut, which I didn't know, to be fair. Are you sure?
I mean, that's yeah, it is. It's his directorial debut. I looked it up as well, which is amazing to have a best adapted screenplay credit to it. Is fantastic. That's a strong start.
Also, and it has done so well.
Can I just quickly apologise, because I don't know if you can hear this, but the dog.
I think it adds to it, Al. I think it adds to the vibe.
So, to digress, I'm so sorry. My neighbour has one of those XL billies. She's lovely, though. Bless her. Like, she's actually a lovely dog, and she was, like, mistreated and stuff, but she's fine with people, but she's not fine with, like, small dogs. So that's what's happened. If you've heard it, I'm so sorry. She's never normally out this late, barking this late. So, yeah. Okay, so we continue. Apologies.
But yeah, so it's amazing that it's done really well, because it's he's won loads of awards. It's been nominated for loads of awards. Has it won?
So we've yet to do the BAFTAs. We're yet to do the BAFTAs. We're yet to do the Oscars. But it's got 5 nominations at the Academy Awards. It's just incredible. I think all definitely... every nomination it's had, so best adapted screenplay, best actor, best picture, best supporting actor, all of those, like, actually chef's kiss, because I think Jeffrey Wright was fantastic in his role. I think Sterling K. Brown was, like, I think one of the emotional cores in this movie. And actually the best adapted screenplay nomination, it's gotten a lot of awards in this award season, but adapted screenplay is definitely where its strength lies. I haven't read Erasure, so I feel like Kath can speak a lot more to that as we go on throughout the episode. But
yes,
it's a common denominator, right? Every award it's gone for, it's picked up a nomination here, or it's picked up the win. So I think that's a lot to say about what they've done, especially because Percival Everett and Cord Jefferson worked closely throughout and were credited as writers. So
I think what I find really interesting about the way it's adapted is, like, the book was obviously written like over 20 years ago, and whilst obviously all the themes and all the characters and all the storyline is the same, like, I think it's done really well to bring it into like the here and now. Like, I know 20 years is like not really that long, but it is in a lot of sense, in terms of, like, I don't know, just like small, like, cultural nods that are in the book compared to like how they've put them into the film. I just think they've done that really well, basically. And I think it's kind of a bit depressing, actually, that it was written 20 years ago, because nothing's changed. So, well, not nothing, but, you know, not enough. So yes, I think that is slightly depressing. But anyway,
we're still having those same conversations, right? And it's interesting to see how far the needle has moved, if at all, in the conversations that we're having. So, like, one of the themes that comes out of this movie is the exploitation of Black America. And I think, like, Jeffrey Wright's character, Monk, and Issa Rae's character, wasn't it Sinatra Golden, something like that? I forgot her name. They have this really interesting conversation towards the end of the movie. They're both jurors in this, like, fictional literature prize, and Issa Rae's character is this, like, novelist who is from, like, a she's a educated Black woman in America. So she's the antithesis, or maybe like the archetype of the stereotype of Blackness in America, right? And she writes a stereotypical book about Blackness in America. And when Monk writes this book, he's doing it like as a rejection for his rejection to those stereotypes. He doesn't think it's going to get picked up, and it does. And he really struggles to understand why, like, they're at loggerheads. He really struggles to understand her motivations for want, embracing it for want of a better word. But and it's just like they're them two navigating this world as authors who are both from the same background, obviously, like in terms of like classmanship, not in terms of like gender. But she's sort of like, well, I'm going to go with it, because if you look at like the black exploitation of the 70s, not exploitation, but like the Shaft movies and stuff like that, that did a lot for Black cinema. And that's how a lot of people got their starts, and they really played into these things. And it's just like a vicious circle, isn't it? So it was a really interesting conversation that they had. I don't know how you felt about that conversation that they had.
Well, yeah, and I think there was so much depth to it, because she didn't know that he'd written the book that they were going to vote as the winner. Well, it's not really a spoiler, guys. You know, we tell spoilers here. We're trying not to tell too many
because you still should go and see this movie.
Yeah. But like, he's written this book that no one, he's used a pen name, no one knows he's written it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in this jury for this literature prize, and he has to like vote on whether his book should win. It's quite fun. And he's tried to win the prize multiple times for his like other literature that he's written. And then he has this conversation. I think it's really interesting that he has that conversation under the guise that he knows he's written that book as a like almost as a joke, and it's been picked up and celebrated, and he's like, what the hell? And then she's like she won the award before or whatever for basically writing a book that he fundamentally, it's not that he disagrees with the book, he just disagrees with that being the only narrative that gets celebrated by Black authors.
It's funny because they both agree that this book is terrible, but he doesn't see what's different about his book in comparison to hers. And she gets very like, oh, hang on a minute. My book is not the same as this. So it was a very interesting conversation that they have discussing those things.
I think at one point he says to her, like, well, where did you go to college or something? Does he say that to her? And he's sort of like questioning her writing a book about something that, and they have a whole conversation, don't they, about how, and she was like, my book is very well researched. Like, I spoke to people, it's people's stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just like an interesting debate that we've seen before in other literature about what you should be able to write about and what you shouldn't, depending on your lived experience.
Yes.
So, yes.
The other really interesting thing that comes out of that discussion in the jury room is that the white judges in the room are the ones to decide what Black voices or narratives should be listened to. They're like, we really need to listen to these narratives. But it's so funny that we've got two people in the room, two Black writers in the room who are educated, and their stories highly and their narratives are highly educated, like, they both are college educated. Jeffrey Wright's character Monk, it comes from an upper middle class family in America. Like, they're all doctors. I mean, he's a doctor in the
he's got a PhD, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's got a PhD. His family are like plastic surgeons and stuff like that, and pediatricians. I can't remember what Tracy Ellis Ross's character is.
Was she Gobson Gynae or whatever?
Gynae, anyway, something like that.
Very impressive doctor.
But one feels compelled to write about narratives of Blackness that's probably more stereotypical to like the ones that of their own lived experience. And that goes to say, like, I appreciate that she's also like, you know, I have to tell these stories because that's also part of Blackness. But mine is well researched. And then he's not making a mockery, but he's trying to exploit that in a different way to show that is exploited, but that it's not like an authentic voice that's telling those stories that she is writing. It was two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You can talk about it and think about it for hours. I think it's amazing, like, how just that one scene. I mean, we've been talking for like 10 minutes about one scene of the film. Actually, that's my favorite bit in the film, where they're sat in this jury room, right? And there's five of them, and the three white characters are on one side, and they've all voted for this book called Fuck. Right, the pen written by the pen name of Jeffrey Wright's character. Yes, that's it. And they're like, this has got to win. This has got to win. And the other two characters are like, Jeffrey Wright and Saray, they're like, we don't agree. Like, we don't want this to be the winner. And they're just like, it's three against one. Like, this story needs to be told or something. And then they pan out of the shot, and there's just like the three white people on one side being like, well, it's three against two. And it's just so, like, it's so on the nose, but it's done so well that scene is just like ingrained in my brain. Like, the way they did that was so good. I thought that was brilliant.
And again, it's the three white voices in the room that decides is the decision makers of the black voice.
Yeah,
it's,
and the way they just set that, like, positioning of the scene up was so simple, but like so effective. And I was like, damn.
This movie hits every time in terms of like its mise-en-scene, its setting, the way it sets things up. Like, you know, if you're a long-time listener of the pod, and hello, first-time listeners, like, I am your TV movie gal. Like, I love visual storytelling. I think the choices made about the music, about the style of shots, it truly like highlights those merits and truly shows why it's like Oscar worthy, because, you know, it's got compelling storytelling, the talent and the cast and the crew, and the four characters are fantastic. Every character has a meaningful use and drives the plot in a way that it needs to, that nothing is wasted. The technical excellence of it, so like the sound design, the cinematography, just stunning. Like, the choice of colors used in a set, like when we go down to, they have this beach house, which is like my dream. Let it be known now, I'm retiring in a beach house somewhere on the coast.
And can't wait to come visit.
Of course, you'll be there with a glass of wine every evening. Come on now. But like, it's fantastic, and I liked that the neighborhood was filled with black people. Like, Maynard, who we'll get to, is like the security guy, like the police person in this like affluent upper middle class American black American community, which you don't see often in media. And also, like, the film style, it has a very strong visual language. Looks so strong. And in that scene that Kath talks about in the jury room is one example of where it's so strong. Another one I really, really love is we will talk about how, like, this was a book, the book itself is a book within a book, and then the film is like a film within, like, similar.
When we came out of the cinema, we were like, it's a book within a book within a film within a film within a it's just like, what?
So many layers. Yeah, exactly. It's like, have we woken up from this layer yet? Are we out of this dream? I love Inception. It's like one of my favorite Christopher Nolan movies, but
I love that film.
It's just like on point. So there's this bit where, you know, Monk decides he's just gonna write this. He's like, he's in his feelings, and he's like, fuck it, I'm gonna go write this movie. I'm gonna write this book, sorry. And he's visualizing these story characters, these like hood characters, and I've got my hands in like quotation marks, right? And what I love was the juxtaposition. So he's writing and these characters are coming into life in front of him, and they break the fourth wall, because they sort of turn to him and go, are you really going to write that? Are we really going to end like this? Like, makes him sort of question his motives for how he's going to write these things, what I absolutely loved was you had these like hood characters, hood again in quotation marks, coming to life in a very upper middle class setting. And I just thought that it really did it really showed how blackness can be reduced to stereotypes. And I just thought it was like a very intelligent way to show it. So you had these like characters in this very posh house being reduced to a stereotype in an archetypal place. And I just, it was very intelligent. It was just very on the nose, very intelligent. I liked the way they broke the fourth wall with, not the fourth wall with us, but with Monk. Very, very well done. And then also just like, I mean, I don't know, what do you think about the scene?
Yeah, I agree. Like, I thought it was amazing. Like, I really appreciated like the different settings and the way it brought you into each setting. And I feel like I almost wasn't always aware of like where it was set in the US, but that didn't really matter. Like, I thought it was great. And like, for example, the agent's office is like this really like, there's books everywhere. There's like stacks of books everywhere. And I think you said this to me like when we were talking about the film. And at one point they're on the phone to the publishing house, like the agent and Jeffrey Wright's character. And it cuts from the agent's office. It's like this sort of like old school office with like filing cabinets and books everywhere. And it cuts to the publishing house and it's just like this sterile, like white, clean environment. And just the juxtaposition of the two is just like really great. And yeah, I think that sort of thing just adds so much to the film.
Yeah, the mise-en-scene, like every setting had a purpose. So that the fact that the publishing house was just, like you said, sterile. It was like very impersonal. It was all about business. It wasn't like, there was nothing loving about that environment. It was all about just churning over a buck. Like it was just very, very, very well thought out. And
I think what's interesting about that as well is like, I feel like when you think about publishing houses, you think about books everywhere and filing cabinets and stuff, but it's obviously not like that. And it is a business. A publishing house is a business. It's not it's interesting.
So what did you think about, I mean, we've got a note here that talks about the ending, and we're not going to spoil the ending. I think that's something we're going to actively try not to do. We're going to talk about a lot of things and themes in detail, but the ending for you, I know you came out and you were like, the fuck?
I came out and I was like, why is there not 20 more minutes of this film? Like, why has it ended? Did they get back together? Like, who knows? Like what? Sorry, that is a spoiler, but it's not really. So it's been 4 days since we watched the film, and since I've come to appreciate the ending for what it was. I've come to appreciate that it needed to end like that so that I had lots of questions about what was going to happen, because in life things are not tied up nice and neatly like that. And I just need to like stop being a hopeless romantic that wants everything tied up in a neat bow every time I finish something that's unanswered. It's like when we read Our Wives Under the Sea, I was like, what do you mean we don't find out what was going on in the centre? Like, what do you mean? Where's my epilogue?
here's me. Like, I love an open, like, I don't love an open ending, not always, but I can like, when it is an open ending and it's like well deserved, I'm like, yeah, sure, fine, let's go. Which I absolutely loved about this one. And we were having a chat before we started recording, because I think we both remember there was a scene earlier in the film where they're talking about endings for black characters, and then those things sort of play out at the end of the book, and we couldn't remember exactly what was said or what that conversation was, or who it was with, but it very much felt like that was playing out for him, like, because it was hard. It sort of writes himself into a corner. He's got himself into this situation where he didn't mean to sell this. He sent it to his pub agent as a joke. It sort of took a life of its own and sort of wrote him into a corner, because then he had to pretend to be this person that doesn't exist. To get it sold as a movie, to get it picked up by a publishing house. So how does this come together? How does this end? I feel like I liked the way that it was like, okay, well, let's explore these opportunities and let's not actually give you an answer. Not really.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't really important. I feel like the familial stuff was probably a more important thing to kind of half resolve.
Which like, kind of did half resolve, didn't yeah. it, in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's like, his brother picks him up. Sorry, yes. We are just spoiling it now. But yeah. So like, yeah, I don't know. I think it is interesting because I when the credits first came up, I was like, oh, is this part of it? Like, are the credits, are we now going to go back into the movie? And it's like, no, it's just the credits. Because in the book, they've got like a whole book within the book as well. So I thought, well, maybe they're just doing that here. Like, maybe they're just being really, like, maybe they're getting really left field. Like, who knows? But they didn't. It wasn't the end. So guys, when the credit comes up, it is the end.
It's definitely said Finn. Done.
Support line in my DMs.
We'll get on to the familial relationships and the cast and the characters, but I think like one big thing which we've touched upon through like talking about like black exploitation and stuff is the publishing industry. It's really hard not to. So it was a key theme. There was no navigating away from it or deterring. Mm. Like, you know, the publishing industry was a key theme here, seen through the jury.
Yeah.
What did you think, Kath?
Well, I just thought it did it really well in a super accessible way. And I think it's super shit that the book was written 20 years ago and the film followed the same storyline, exactly the same situation. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we're in a time where books like Yellowface are mm-hmm. flying off the shelf and the publishing industry is being very self-aware. Are they being self-aware or are they just profiting off it? Who knows? Mm-hmm. And it's just an interesting time, I think, for the publishing industry, and not just the publishing industry, like just entertainment in general.
Yeah.
But what I think, we were talking about this before we started recording, and basically I think sometimes I forget that I'm in a bubble, right? I live in London, I work in advertising. People talk about things like this all the time. Like, I have daily conversations with people about inclusion, diversity, race. Like, it is, you know, a day-to-day part of my life where I will read books, watch films, have conversations where I'm talking about things like this. And I'm, you know, thinking about the publishing industry and how it might be able to improve, and like thinking about adverts and whether they're representative or not. Like, it is part of my life. And I feel like sometimes I forget that I'm in that bubble. And I think when something like this film comes along, because obviously there is some criticism in the sense that like, should, like, it's a satire, right? And like, when does that go too far? Like, you know, if we just make it funny, like, is it productive? But actually, what I think is really great about this film is that a lot of people will go and watch this film. It's been nominated for countless awards now, and it's a funny film. Like, it's a good entertaining thing to watch, and a lot of people will go and watch it that aren't in our kind of bubble where we're talking about things like this all the time. And what I hope is that it will open up conversations for people that don't talk about race and racism in our country, not just like, because we're in the UK, right?
Yeah.
And like, the conversation here has its own nuances compared to in America, but you know, fundamentally conversations are similar. And I think what is great is that people will go and watch this film and then have those conversations that perhaps might not be having them on the regular basis anyway.
Yeah.
And it reaches those like peripheries of society where we kind of are almost like, it's very on the nose. It's nothing that we don't know about already, and it's nothing that we don't want to change or we're trying to change. But actually, when it's this widespread, I think it does a lot to sort of help bring that conversation to other people. I don't know if you agree.
No, I do. I thought that you said it so eloquently when we were talking off camera, off recording, that I just was like, I'm going to let you rip because I don't know.
I'm rambling.
No, not at all. And I mean, inevitably, we're going to have these conversations again in 20 years because how much does the needle move? And things don't change unless the institutions change. And
I don't know if the institutions will ever change, but
yes, well,
yeah. I'd like to think that we won't be having these conversations in 20 years, but
I like to have faith in our generation, but I'm not sure.
No, well,
as I said, I'm in a bubble, so like people I talk to, I'm like, well, when we're in charge, we're not going to be doing this kind of shit, but I'm in a bubble.
As soon as you leave London, it's a different story, like race, class, like it's a completely different conversation. Completely different conversation. I only have to go like 20 minutes out into Essex and it's like a different conversation completely. So, I mean, not for the people whose lived experience it is. I think it's very similar, but like these things aren't talked about in the same way. So,
but like for people who, like white people who are not talking about race and they're not, it's not that like, for me, like this kind of film, it's not gonna like, if you are a horrible human being and you're like racist, misogynistic and whatever else, right? It's not gonna make a difference, which I mean, it's just a real shame. Like, yeah. But if you're like, because you're an arsehole anyway, right? You're just an arsehole. But if you're somebody who just hasn't really thought about it because you live in a bubble somewhere else where the bubble's just not having those conversations, that's where it can make a difference, I think.
Yeah. Might just open a few eyes, might just get people to go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just
open up a single conversation with someone that you can then be like, learn from it and be like, oh yeah, and also have you read Yellowface, because it tackles a similar like thing. And this is obviously just about the publishing industry, like we're not talking about like, it's obviously
everything else.
But god, like, should we write a reading list? I think we need to write a reading list.
We do. Here go, here's some further reading for you based off Erasure/American fiction/Erasure.
Something that happened in 2020 was that people did compile like reading lists and like watch lists for people who actually wanted to educate themselves, which I think was great. Like there were a lot of like lists online that were super accessible for everyone to just access and be like, okay, I need to educate myself, where do I start? And there's like, go watch this, this and this and read these three books as a starting ground and then go from there kind of thing. So
we keep doing these
maybe
things. Keep having
added
these
to those lists, basically.
Yeah, we keep doing these things, we keep having these conversations. I just hope that one day, like, we don't have to, like,
I hope so too, mate.
Anyway,
yeah,
I want to talk about the performance of the cast and the characters, because we have a whole the characters in this is very well casted. I don't know that if you've put anyone else doing any other thing that it would have worked as well. I just think the talent we have here is fantastic, and then the characters themselves are all going through something. So we have Monk, who's our protagonist, played by Jeffrey Wright. He's been nominated for several, like he's nominated for like best leading actor at the Academy Awards. I think his voice is amazing, by the way. Oh, such a great voice. I was like, yeah, I wouldn't kick him out of bed. Not the point. But he's our protagonist. He's really bitter. He's quite an isolated character. He wants to be recognised for the work that he's worthy of doing. He doesn't want it to be reduced down to stereotypes. And the irony is that what he's recognised for is exactly what he's fighting against. And the four characters, like, are chef's kiss. And they really illuminate, you know, where his pitfalls are, where he can be like lifted, and they really help drive the narrative forward. And there's so much to talk about in regards to the performances here. So, I mean, I don't know where to start.
Can we start Lorraine?
Because we can start Lorraine.
Lorraine's
yeah.
biggest fan. We
must protect her at all costs.
Sorry, what an excellent character. Like, I love her. I'm obsessed.
Yeah, she's the heart of this movie. She's the emotional core of this movie. She helps drive the narrative forward. There's things that happen
obviously, and we're going to have to spoil the death of Lisa because we can't not to help.
It does happen early on, guys.
It happens early on, so we're not really spoiling that much. But that has to happen for certain things to take place. But I feel like Lorraine's character is really the emotional heart. And while the family is very dysfunctional, it's Lorraine who everyone shows up for. She is part of the family, but she's not by blood, by, you know, she works for the family, and she goes on this journey herself where, as things, you know, fall apart and come together again, she finds her own self. She finds a lover in Maynard. She has an identity outside of this family, and everyone shows up for her, no matter what the dysfunction is, no matter what madness or sort of like hijinks they get up to, they always show up for Lorraine. And I think one great scene that displays that is like Sterling K. Brown, and we'll get to him because he was fantastic. He's also another emotional core heart to this movie, but he's on his own self-discovery. He's recently come out. It's had repercussions because his wife caught him with another man, but he's now living his life, this life that has been denied him for so long because, you know, he's just tried to assimilate. Mm. He says he's going away back to wherever it is that he lives, but he doesn't. He goes to the beach house. And when he goes to the beach house, he brings these toy boys, and it's quite a funny scene, but it's got a lot of heart. So they all rock up to the beach house because Lorraine is going to get married. And then he's there with his toy boys and all of this drug paraphernalia. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? Monk is about to let rip into him. Like, you've got to get out of here. You're not welcome anymore. And it's Lorraine that goes, no, it's okay. It's okay to be you. It's okay to be acting out. Like, and it's okay to be trying to find yourself. I'm getting married. I want you here. Clean up. Come downstairs, let's get on with it. And she has so much heart, and everyone every time shows up for her. He was like, I'm so sorry, I did know this, I wasn't thinking. And he shows up for her. Every character shows up for her every single time, and she's really the emotional beating pulse of this movie. Sorry,
I love I agree. And I love that in at her wedding, which by the way is just my favorite part of the whole film, Cliff's friends come to the wedding.
Yes, they do. Cliff's mates come. The guys are like, oh, we come. And it's so funny because after you have that really sort of like tense, Monk is going to have a go at him for being irresponsible moment.
Which, like, you can understand why his brother would be like, what the fuck, bro?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Look, but what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, you have, and then
the guy's like, I can make some omelets or whatever it was. It just broke the tension.
Did you I think in the when we were watching it, sorry, what were you saying?
No, I wasn't saying anything.
I think when we were watching it, you literally whispered to me like, I love that they're there.
And it's just like, it's an acceptance that Sterling K. Brown's character Cliff is just seeking. And there's this really heartbreaking moment that he has with his mother, who's going through Alzheimer's, right? Again, you would think maybe the mother is the emotional part of this movie. And she is to an extent, of course. They're seeing their mother, like, lose her mind. And that's a very difficult thing to live through and experience. But again, all of the family, familial relationships are strained. Mm. She's not thinking right, and he's gone to see her in this care home, and he's dancing with her, and it's very, very lovely, lovely mother and son moment. And she makes this comment about him being queer, like something like, see, I knew you wasn't queer, or something like that. And you just see his heart break because it's who he is. And his mother has made a comment that
this film does so much if you think about it.
Yeah,
like with that storyline as well, it's just such like a it's not even like it's a side storyline, but it's so important as well. And it's just it's really emotional
because he's coming into his own in this movie, and he's obviously like he's gone through a divorce as well. His wife isn't talking to him, his kids isn't talking to him.
he's just trying to find himself. He said, like, you know, I'm a gay black man in this like random town. I'm the oldest person there, and everyone thinks I look like I am Tyler Perry, and I'm not. Like, he's reduced down to like a stereotype. So he's really coming into his own, but he has, in the way that his brother lacks emotional. What's the word I'm looking for? He has much. What is it? You know, he sits down with his brother at the wedding and he says, you need to show your heart. Monk has a girlfriend called Coral. He sits down and he tells him, like, you need to make yourself open. He's much more open as a character than Monk is. I think he's much more in tune with his feelings, not his feelings, but his emotions, like with himself. But because he's like had to go through that process of being in tune with himself.
I feel like he's like a step ahead of Monk in that, like, he's been through like the divorce and everything, and he's like, now I'm gonna live my true self for the first time in my life. So he's kind of like been through that already, and Monk's like behind him, and he's just like imparting that wisdom on him, being like, you can get here too, like you can feel happy and secure in who you are. You just have to be open to it.
Yeah. And I think Cliff's character, what Sterling K. Brown brings to his character is like a really, there's a sense of softness and a sense of like angst, and he plays that really well, that subtly.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a stunning performance. So I don't know that he'll get the Oscar, because it's a really strong lineup. It's a tough category.
Like, I think just being nominated is like very. Like, is to be celebrated anyway. Like,
exactly. So that's Lorraine and Sterling K. Brown. And Cliff. On to the
list. So we could talk about this. We could do a whole episode just on these characters.
So we talk about, when we talked about Monk, because I know that you'd said about the romance aspect of it, because he has a romance.
I don't know, like, I feel like, so
it's very fleeting.
You made a good point and I agree with you, but I just felt like the romance wasn't very necessary in the film or the book. But you were like, yeah, but it makes him come out of his shell, and I'm like, yeah, and also she's the reason why he's suddenly like, I need to maybe reveal myself as the author of this book, which we don't know whether he actually does or not, but I just felt like it didn't get resolved. Like, you don't know what's happened. Like, she was just kind of there and then she wasn't, which I guess is like really like quite realistic. But then, like, I'm just hopeless romantic, and I wanted there to be a big fanfare where they like ran into each other's arms at the end. Sorry. I'm not sorry about it. That's what I wanted.
I think, you know, when we talk about full characters and stuff like that, and I think she highlights some of his quirks, and I think her raison d'etre, if you know, is like to bring out an emotional vulnerability to him that his family can't bring, because he's always in conflict with his family. So like, I think that contrast is quite nice. And also, we're told countless times that he's so similar to his dad. His dad, he was like the apple of his dad's eye. He had all of his focus and attention, and because of that, he missed a lot of his dad's indiscretions. Like, his dad stepped out on his mother, had several affairs, but the siblings knew this because it was so obvious to them, because they didn't get the same attention and love and affection from their dad that he did. And that's why the siblings are so well connected and are more on a level with each other than he is with them. And that's why he's so like in contrast or ostracized from the family in that way. So I think that Coraline's character, as fleeting as she is, and I'm glad she put him in his place as well, absolutely, and she was right to when they had their moment. I really liked her, especially because, you know, when he met her for the first time and he liked her, and then her ex came and he got all like this, and she was just like, relax.
Yeah, but people have histories. Like, that was kind of unnecessary. Like, she didn't need to have the ex. Like, he just never came back into the fold again.
No, that's true. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, that's true.
But I do agree. Like, I really liked her character. And, like, I also agree with you that she needed to be there for his character. But I just want to see them get back together. In my head, they get back together. Sorry, but I don't want anyone to tell me otherwise. Like, they get back together and they live happily ever after, okay?
He needs her.
Thank you.
He needs her.
I need them to be together.
So, hey, Percival Everett, I hope you're doing well. If you could just write that in, if you haven't got to it in the book already, that would be great. Thank you. Lots of love, Kath.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Or if you could just have that as like a extra, you know, bonus content applause on the DVD or the HD, the Blu-ray.
We're like, at the end of Marvel movies, after the credit, there's another scene.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that.
That's all I needed, scene, guys. Just a 5-second clip of those two together, okay?
And then finally, I feel like we should address Lisa, which is played by Tracy Ellis Ross. Uh-huh. Because she is very brief. She is in like the first 10 minutes of the movie and then she's gone. She blink and you miss her.
Yes.
So I wondered whether there was more on the cutting room floor for her character. I don't feel like she needed to be in it any more or any longer than she was, because actually, when you think about it, she had to go for the narrative to move on. But it doesn't have the emotional gut punch you would hope it would do. Kind of like for her to have gone, to just put her to have died that way, like it wasn't quite the emotional gut punch that you'd hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like her death, not to compare loads to the book, because obviously, like, you have to change stuff when you adapt a book to a film and stuff, but in the book, her death is a lot more dramatic in that she is murdered. Sorry for the spoiler. She runs, like, a place where, like, people have abortion stuff. I don't know if it's actually an abortion clinic, but she supports abortion totally, and she is shot by a protester. And I feel like they took that out of the book, probably to make the film what it was, because the film is a lot more lighthearted than the book. And I feel like then she's there for the plot in the film. She's a brilliant character, and like she does a lot as well, but I feel like you don't have the emotional feel. Like when she gets killed in the book, I was like, oh my God. Like I literally had to put the book down. I was on the bus and I just had to stop reading. So I was like, Jesus Christ. But you don't get that same emotional reaction in the film, which I think is fine, because there's enough emotion in the film as it is. And the film is like very emotional throughout, good and bad emotion. But I think like she's definitely used a lot more for the plot. I mean, she's used for the plot in the same way in the book, but do you know what I'm trying to say? Like,
yeah,
I just feel like she needs to be there because she needs to be the catalyst for, like, because she's holding everything together, right?
Yeah.
And she's looking after her mum, she's sorting the bills out, she's paying the bills, she's like, she's being the go-between between the brothers, and then she's gone. So everyone else has to sort their shit out because she's not there anymore.
Yeah.
And if she was still there, then would he have written the book? Like, it's all the catalyst for everything that comes after that, right?
Yeah, exactly. I would say also, like, two things. First of all, I'm glad that they had changed that, because I think that whole pro and then, like, that
well,
discussion
they
about
the whole film
that yeah that. it's a too big of a discussion to condense into a film that's also addressing lots of other things. So I
agree
think that for the sake of what they're trying to achieve, maybe it was the right decision not to admit that.
I agree, yeah. And I think the conversation is very well, in the last few years the conversation has got very, very, very intense in terms of that, like in America specifically,
so Lisa's part, like you said before, like she is the one to keep everyone down, she's the connective tissue between the family and navigating the family dynamics. And I just thought it was quite ironic that even though she's going through her shit, because all of them are going through their shit, she is still this strong black female character, this stereotype, and then she's gone. So she doesn't get much of an arc outside of that. And I just thought that's how, like, you know, black women in media are either the mammy gone with the wind type or the strong black female, and then that's it. And so she doesn't really get an arc outside of that, but it's fine because her point of being, like, her raison d'etre is for her to help the family restart. So and Sophie Ellis-Bextor, sorry, Tracy Ellis-Ross was fantastic.
Someone's thinking about Saltburn.
Fucking hell. Sophia Lillis Brooks. So it's a black woman. She was great. She's fantastic in everything that she does. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think all the characters are great. Like, every single one of them is brilliant. Like, even the agent, love him.
Adam Brody is fantastic in, maybe he's typecast in this sort of like annoying agent type.
Do you think he's annoying?
I don't think he's.
I know what you mean by the typecast thing, but like, I think he's brilliant. I think he's great.
I think he's good in this film, but he's, you know, that wannabe agent. Oh, yeah, I'm going to give you big bucks. Like, that's his thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's his like stick.
You know the guy that plays the. Like the agent and the publishing assistant or the publishing marketing team or whatever he is. Oh, yeah. He plays the same character. Every movie I've ever seen him in, he plays basically the same person, but he's brilliant at it. I just thought he was so funny.
Oh, yeah, that was funny. So funny moments or honourable mentions, you know, when he changes it to fuck, the title of the book, and he's like, okay. No,
yeah, connect internally.
That was a great moment. We talked about the beach house bit, which was also heartfelt. Oh, you have one.
My favourite bit, well, one of my favourite bits, is when he goes into the bookshop with his sister and he's asking for his book and he's this poor, like, bookseller assistant guy is like, I don't make the rules. Anyway, like this little teenager is like squirming, but and he basically, his books are not in the right section. They're in like the American and African-American fiction section.
Yeah.
And Jeff Wright's character's like, what the fuck? And so he just picks up like this whole shelf of his books and he just moves them across, and his sister comes up and she's like, what are you doing, Monk? Like, stop it, it's so embarrassing. But I'm just like, yes, power to the people, like, you move your books. And I said to Ellie, I was like, the completely different context obviously, but I was like, that would be me. I'd be moving my books from one shelf to another and I'd be like, no. Well, how dare you put my books there?
It's so good. Do well.
It was brilliant. But I just thought it was so good because it's like, who decides the category? Like, and like, oh, you can, it's like, it's quite an on the nose moment of the story, but it's like, for God's sake, like, why? Like, I don't know, just I really liked that sort of like, because it's just quite a short scene and they could have quite easily cut it out, I think, of the film. But I think it actually is a really good part where you really get to know his character as well, where he's just like, fuck this shit, like, sorry, but like, this is ridiculous. And then he's just like, yeah, well, he's not sorry about it, he's unapologetic about it. But I think it's a really good scene where like it adds quite a lot of like humor and like entertainment to the film, but also says a lot about his character that you then go on to see how he like it escalates basically.
Yeah,
so I like that bit.
See his frustration.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Go watch it, guys. It's really good. It's very good.
I would say go and see it.
It's like 94% Rotten Tomatoes. Like, there's a reason for that. It's very good.
94%?
Yeah.
Whoa. That's pretty high.
Very high.
But yeah. But worthy. I would say... yeah, we both really enjoyed it. I'd say also read the book. I think the book's very cleverly written, and I'm the kind of gal that has to read the book before I see the film. So if you're the same kind of person, it is worth reading the book still. And yeah, thanks again to the Tandem Collective for letting us see it and for sponsoring this episode.
Yay.
End scene.
All right, guys. Well, enjoy this bonus. Let us know if you've watched it. If you plan to watch it, hit us up on the socials at We Are Bookish Pod.
And we'll chat to you soon.
Bye.
Love you, bye.
Love you, bye. And that's the app. If you like the episode, please leave us a lovely review, subscribe and share with your friends, and we'll love you forever. Follow us on socials at We Are Bookish Pod. Thanks for listening.